This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about tiny homes. An expo is coming to the Central Coast to show people how to build and live in them and how they can be profitable, too.
And the homeowner may move into the tiny home and make a heck of a lot of rent renting out their front home.
And later, what happens to race horses when they can't race anymore? One local organization is helping as many as they can get ready for new careers.
We prepare them to be trail horses or, you know, light performance horses. They kind of make up the bulk of our foster to adopt program.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 7th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Tiny homes. You may have heard a lot about them lately. Just last year, San Luis Obispo city officials created rules so residents can put tiny houses on wheels on their property to either live in or rent out to somebody else. An expo is coming to town this weekend that will explain every facet of this housing trend that's sweeping the nation. I recently sat down with Ann Wyatt of Central Coast nonprofit Smart Share Housing Solutions to get to know more about the expo and all the different kinds of tiny home options out there.
The Tiny Footprint Expo is a tiny house and net zero expo at tinyfootprintexpo.com. And it is a 3-day event to help educate and inspire people and help get more safe, affordable, sustainable housing here in San Luis Obispo and other places.
Okay, where's it going to be at?
It's going to be at the Madonna Meadows. It's going to be Friday, October 11th, Saturday, October 12th, and Sunday, October 13th.
Okay.
The Friday activities will be a VIP opening, so it's by invite only or a special $75 ticket. And then the Saturday and Sunday time, Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 3, will be general admission at $10 at the door, $8 in advance.
So let's just go ahead and start off. For anyone listening right now that's not familiar, what's a tiny home?
What's a tiny home? Well, it's a loaded question. So there are a whole lot of definitions of tiny because it has a lot to do with who you're sitting next to. So next to a 5,000 square foot home, 2,000 can be tiny. But here in the city has defined tiny houses on wheels as under 400 square feet.
And that's here in the city of San Luis Obispo. Now, they were the only city in the county that has tiny home regulations right now. Is that correct?
That's correct. The city council took a strong leadership position on housing and has made the city one of the first cities in the country, actually, to allow tiny houses on wheels in residential backyards in the city with some restrictions.
Well, why have rules and restrictions? Why can't anybody just, you know, put a tiny house in their backyard or on the back of a trailer and take it with them anywhere and put it in front of their house or so?
Well, if we set up zoning and controls to help protect the public interest, we could have a fun and long discussion on to the degree we actually do that and how much our exclusionary codes aren't serving the public interest right now. But basically, we want to ensure safe housing and neighborhood protections. So it's a balancing act. And so the city council made what seems to me a bold allowance for tiny houses, but also ensuring protections for the neighborhoods. So you can put a tiny house now in a backyard on wheels. That's a tiny house on wheels of 400 square feet and under. But it needs to look like a conventional house. And it needs to be hooked up to utilities and be permitted and allow some side setbacks and be to the back or the side. So there are some insurances that the neighborhood won't be unduly impacted. And then there are legitimate issues to the neighborhood in these that we want to watch out with increasing density in general of increased use of parking, noises, smoke, aesthetics, and resource consumption. So we want to take all of those into account when we look at putting tiny houses in backyards and or I'm anywhere sure else.
These are all issues that are going to be unpacked at the Tiny Footprint Expo?
That is. We'll look at them one by one, really. The safety issues and aesthetic concerns, efficiency issues. Some people are concerned that these tiny houses won't be built well and efficiently. So we have the national code writers from Florida coming. Robin Butler is an engineer with NOAA, and they actually certify tiny houses for their construction integrity and efficiency. So he'll be talking about how they operate that process.
You know, tiny homes have appealed to me. I'm young. Ish, single, I don't have any pets, so it seems like a good idea. It's the cost that is a little scary to me at times. I don't really know how much to spend or where to start. So can you sort of break down how much they cost?
Sure. Well, so there are two components to the cost of tiny houses, really. And one is the construction or purchase of the house itself. And so the range of houses that we'll be showing at the expo and that are generally available for sale now by the thousands are from $40,000 to $100,000 for the house.
Oh, wow.
And so there are lots of good ones that meet the code and look beautiful and are efficient and function in the $40,000 to $70,000 range for the house. So that's the primary expense. But then the secondary expense here in the city is the cost of putting the thing in. So you've got to get a permit, which is around $869. And then you've got to get a permit for the utilities hookups, which might be another $800. And then you need to pay someone or be handy and able to run the electrical, the sewer lines, and the water lines to the unit. So the get lucky scenario is that the hookup and permitting costs could be $5,000, but we're expecting probably an average of $10,000 for the hookup cost. So you're looking maybe at an average house of $60,000 and a hookup cost of, say, conservatively $10,000 to make it legal and safe and have electricity and running water, the basics on your site.
Sounds like the Tiny Footprint Expo would be great for someone like me that's interested but not handy at all to start getting some of these tips and tricks on maybe how to get that way.
That's right. We'll be focusing the Friday VIP opening activities from 3 to 7 on policymakers. So we'll be looking then at kind of bigger picture policy and safety and coding and zoning issues. But Saturday and Sunday, there will be two tracks of workshops going all day. One will be a housing track that our office at SmartShare Housing will run. And then the other track will be a general environmental and sustainability track that our partners at Ecologistics and Slow Climate Coalition are operating. And so those workshops will help people, the general public, anyone interested, understand what the codes are around tiny houses, how to build them, where builders are, what to look for if you're thinking about getting a tiny house. So those workshops will offer a lot of information. And then just seeing the houses that the builders have, we have several reputable builders, several local ones who will be showing off their houses, including the first permitted tiny house in a backyard here in SLO. Kenny Gazin is starting up a building operation, Simple Living, Simple Homes, and he'll be running bus tours hourly from the expo to his tiny home in his backyard on Mill Street. And so it is incredible. So that opportunity to see the brand new tiny home in front of a historic Mill Street home and how beautifully it works will be a wonderful example of what can happen.
So you are probably familiar with all different types of tiny homes. What are some of your favorite features or functions of different homes that you've seen?
Different builders put in a variety of gadgets. So Kenny has built in a folding stairway in his Mill Street home that he'll show people. And so often, if you've seen the tiny house videos, usually they involve a loft. They don't all. We'll be showing a fully ADA accessible home at the expo too. But often there's a loft, and accessing the loft can be a little tricky because in a narrow house, then you might have 3 feet of stairs kind of blocking your movability in the lower level. And so the folding stairs are very unique to Kenny's house, so that's a fun feature. Otherwise, I like the simplicity and the small size. It's less to maintain and keep up, and I'm a fan of efficient living and doing other things now than just spending my time and having to work hard to make a lot of money for housing expenses. And with a growing population of singles, there are a lot of people in that position. 36% of the residents of San Luis Obispo City are single-person households like you and me. And so they're not always looking for large spaces, and even if they can afford them, they don't necessarily add value. So the smaller, clean, functional, well-designed space is of general importance to me and others who are interested in this type of living, along with the affordability component that it's less to have to pay for and work hard to make money just to go into the housing.
On the affordability aspect again, is there, compared to buying a house where you put a down payment and you have, you know, payments and a mortgage and stuff, are these options available for tiny homes, or is there financing available for tiny homes?
Yes, there is financing. We'll have a couple of lenders available. A representative is coming from Mechanics Bank to the expo to talk about lending on tiny homes, but generally they fall under RV loan packages. So they fall under kind of 5 to 7 year payback periods of a typical RV payment package. And so it's an interesting and an important note that one of the components of the tiny homes is, and why I'm so excited about tiny homes on wheels, is because they can be purchased and installed relatively quickly. And for around $70,000 or $80,000, like we've said, maybe in some get lucky scenarios, even less, that compares to an ADU on a fixed foundation that's averaging $150,000 to $200,000 to build in San Luis Obispo and other places. So it's a fraction of that cost. And if you run paybacks on $70,000, you can actually pay that back in 5 or 7 years, even from an affordable studio rent, which is about $1,000 a month. So as a houser focused on affordability and access issues, that we can provide housing without any government subsidy through the private realm and actually make homeowners money after they pay off their loans in some number of years, that's huge. And yeah, that's what is a really important component of this, that it's not just some novelty, but it's actually a way to provide a new type of efficient housing that's amenable to some percentage of us that don't want a lot of space and house to keep up with and can make homeowners money by putting these in besides. So it's a nice package of doing public service by providing needed housing and providing income to homeowners who may need help.
Speaking of needed housing, there is a movement across the United States of tiny home villages for the homeless. Cities like Austin, Texas are doing this. There has been a push for that here in San Luis Obispo, but not a lot of luck. Is that conversation going to be had at this expo about how to house the homeless with tiny homes?
Yes, it is. Tiny homes don't just fall under one category. So it is helpful to point out smart share housing is really focusing on gearing up codes and ordinances and government entities toward allowing tiny houses in backyards. And so in general, that'll mean the placement of one, maybe two. Portland allows 2 or 3 ADUs per backyard, but we're really arguing for one unit in a backyard. And then there are groups such as Hope's Village here in the county and Webb's operating in Santa Barbara County that are advocating for tiny home villages. And so that's an important component of this, an opportunity. It is quite different from an organizational standpoint. At SmartShare, we argue for using existing resources efficiently. So we look at the backyard as an already impact kind of existing resource that's proximate to utility hookups and existing roads and infrastructure. The tiny house villages are an important opportunity to house people with little means, but they often require developing new sites. you couldn't really just move one into a backyard with several units, realistically. You'd need to bring in water and sewer and roads. And so it's an important concept and opportunity to be able to do that and minimize the housing cost by using tiny houses on wheels. But you still do have the infrastructure impacts. And so we'll have advocates for both tracks, advocating for the use in the backyards. And Becky Jorgensen from Hope's Village will be showing her cow, her tiny house on wheels. And Webbs will be there with the house that they're building as a community village model, similar to what you've probably seen in Austin, the Community First Village, and many others around the country. So we're absolutely supportive and hoping that we'll get such a village here in San Luis Obispo soon.
I noticed from looking at your flyer, it's not just going to be tiny homes, also vans are going to be looked at.
At SmartShare, we are committed to helping people understand that there are more housing options out there than commonly recognized. And although vans and schoolies and RVs...
Now, wait a second. What's a schoolie?
A schoolie is a converted school bus.
Okay, cool.
So although these things aren't legal in San Luis Obispo, and we're not necessarily advocating that they be legal tomorrow, we want to show that these types of housing, different types of housing, work wonderfully for different people by showing how well it can work and the types of people living in these. We think it can help people expand options.
So tiny homes also present an option for people to be able to use their land to make money to pay off their actual permanent home, correct?
That's right. So that can happen in a couple of ways. And because of this is new, we don't know exactly how it'll play out yet. But the scenario that we expect mostly is that if I were a homeowner, I could buy a tiny house and place it in my backyard and get the permit and then rent it out at an affordable rate or market rate, depending. And so I could generate income that way. Another opportunity that's new with this tiny house on wheels opportunity is I could not do anything and I could just rent out my backyard to someone who has a house. And that's actually already happened in San Luis Obispo. The city is in the process of processing the first four permits, and two of the houses have already been placed in backyards. And the second one that went in is a case where a homeowner met a person with a tiny house at one of our workshops. And so they connected, and the tiny house owner leases the backyard of the homeowner. So he doesn't own the tiny house or maintain it, but the owner does. And that's an interesting opportunity, particularly for women. Single women are homeowners at a rate of twice the rate of single men. Women want to own their home, feather their nests, and kind of be in control of their homey space, but they often don't have the financial means to purchase, and they take on less debt than men. So having the opportunity to own a home but not have to buy the land with it is huge. So that's an opportunity for the homeowner. And the third option that we may be seeing happen is that the homeowner may buy the tiny house, put it in the back, and move into it. Because the homeowner doesn't want their larger front home, and the homeowner may move into the tiny home and make a heck of a lot of rent renting out their front home. And so we don't know how it'll go exactly, what percentage will be which, but we expect that we'll see all of these scenarios playing out.
We've talked a lot about people living alone in these houses. Are there environments where people, where families with more than one person can live in a tiny home?
There are. You'll see at the expo, you'll meet families living in tiny homes, so it can be done. We'll have a family traveling around the world in their bus, and a couple of families living in tiny homes. So it certainly can and is being done. I haven't succeeded at sharing tight spaces with others for long periods of time. So I see this as mostly an opportunity for the increasing percentage of single-person households. Certainly, if some people can and want to share spaces, small spaces with more people, that's an option available. But I see it primarily as serving the increasing number of singles. And that's 36% of the San Luis Obispo city population. population, and about a quarter of the population in the county and nationally that are single-person households. So that's not some minuscule number of people that could be served.
While tiny homes on wheels are only allowed in the city of San Luis Obispo right now, is there a push to get them placed anywhere else in the county?
There is, yes. The Grover Beach City Council has it on their agenda. Their staff is looking at an ordinance to allow them, and the county has a draft ordinance written. So we're hopeful that the county supervisors will be supportive and pass an ordinance allowing them in the near future. And we would like to see all jurisdictions in the county and elsewhere allow them. We're hoping in the county where there are larger lots, there may be some fewer requirements for hookups to utilities, but that's something county planning and the supervisors will have to decide on.
Well, Anne, I want to thank you so much for coming in. Tell everyone where they can go to find out more information about the Tiny Foot Expo, where it's going to be and what it's going to be like.
TinyFootprintExpo.com, or if you don't have internet access, call our office at Smart Share Housing, 805-215-5474. The expo will be October 11th to 13th at the Madonna Meadows in San Luis Obispo.
That was Ann Wyatt of Central Coast nonprofit Smart Share Housing Solutions talking about the Tiny Footprint Expo coming to San Luis Obispo this coming weekend. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Tyler Pratt. What happens to a horse when it ages out of its career? One local organization is trying to make sure they have another one. Correspondent Tom Wilmer recently got a tour of an equine rescue operation in Monterey County.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Red Wings Horse Sanctuary.
My name is Desiree. I'm the office manager at Red Wings Horse Sanctuary. Our mission is to rescue abused and neglected horses. Primarily, our horses come from animal services, but they also come from a variety of situations that are at risk. So we have burros and mustangs from the Bureau of Land Management. We also have a partnership that are not neglected horses, but with the race industry. There is another nonprofit we partner with called Karma, and we get a lot of off-track thoroughbreds from that program, and they need some rehabilitation.
Are they done, or sometimes they are rehabbed
mostly,
and they go back?
They have been taken from off the track. They're done with their careers on the track, and some of them come to us with a variety of small injuries, but you know, they need a little time off to be a horse, and then basically we prepare them to be trail horses or, you know, light performance horses. Mm-hmm. They kind of make up the bulk of our foster to adopt program.
So you're located way out in the middle of nowhere in Monterey County.
We are,
yeah.
Yes.
So you're not too far from Hunter Liggett, the Army base, and the town of Lockwood.
That's right. If you know where Lake San Antonio is and Lake Nacimiento, we are past those two lakes in the little town of Lockwood.
And it follows that one of the reasons you're here is because availability of acreage.
That's right. Our sanctuary was founded in 1991, and we were originally in the Carmel, Monterey area. Mm-hmm. That land the owners wanted to sell, and then at that time, a board member who is just wonderful purchased this property for our use.
Yeah. But now, going forward, I seem to recall that you're in the planning stages of moving your operation to outside of Paso Robles.
Paso Robles, so it's going to be off of Union Road and the 46 in Paso, kind of nestled in with some of the wineries there. We are very excited about the move. We're waiting for the final stages of our construction permits to come in, but we have gotten some building materials delivered, so we are just anxious to break ground.
And when you move, you're still going to have the luxury of some decent acreage?
Yes, we are on 146 acres. Here we're 167.
And I would think that a really cool advantage of your location going forward would be visual awareness as drive-bys and whatnot. For example, I only know about you because when I'm on my way to Army Base Headquarters at Hunter Liggett, I go by your turnoff and I see your sign. I go, ooh. What's that?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. You know, since we are in a rural location, we have some very loyal volunteers who've been coming for years, but we're hoping off of the 46 and in the Paso Robles community, we'll get more volunteers from the Central Coast. We'll get people stopping on the wine trail and saying, hey, we want to do something other than taste wine today.
Let's take a little tour
around. Sure. All righty, let's get going.
It's a warm day here, huh?
Yeah, it is. I think it's going to be about 100, 102 today. We have our inner barn area here. These are the horses that need a little extra special care. Some of them have visual impairment.
So their needs are greater?
Yeah, that's right. So we're pulling up here, and we have a couple of horses that have some health issues. Anna on your right, she is fully blind, an Appaloosa, which is kind of a white with brown spots,
yeah.
A beautiful coat color. She is one of our sweetest old ladies. And this horse here, his name is Don't Stalk Me, and he is one of the off-track thoroughbreds I mentioned. So he's here in our quarantine area because he's just come from the program, and he is going to be evaluated. So once
that has to do with socialization?
It's more for our equine care manager. Her name is Sarah Ruggeroni. She is going to evaluate his behavior, figure out which other horses he might be best in. As we travel a little further, we're going to go down what we call Thoroughbred Alley, where we have some larger turnouts, larger pastures, and he will probably go in with two or three other horses. Little Oliver over here, I'll just pull up a little bit. He came from a recent abuse and neglect case in San Luis Obispo County.
Oh, is that the one where you had to take in like 20 or so?
Yeah, there were 34 horses total. We ended up taking six of those, and I believe there are 10 or so still to be placed. So, you know, we took the ones that were least likely to be adopted. Oliver had never had any good care. He'd never been dewormed, never had his vaccine. So he has some liver issues and ongoing health issues from that. We have some other horses in the inner barn area. These horses that we're seeing here, they are from the Pryor Mountains in Montana. So they were a herd of wild Mustangs that we took, I believe, the year 2000.
Was this through BLM?
They were originally, I believe they were government BLM Mustangs, but they were actually from a herd in Montana. Our other Mustangs have come from the Devil's Garden herd in Northern California. But this herd, they're all in 19 or in their 20s now.
They look related.
I believe they all are. They were a family group.
Since these are senior horses, mm-hmm. And they were wild Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any hope of them being adopted out? And what could their use be?
This particular herd, they are what we call semi-feral. So they will never be adopted.
Are they halterable?
These ones, most of them are halter broke, I believe. We have two other Mustangs that mm-hmm. are going to be adoptable. Mm-hmm. And they came from the Devil's Garden herd in Northern California. And they came to us completely feral. But they are now halter broke. They can stand for the farrier, pick up their feet mm-hmm. and get a little trim. They will be probably broke to ride in the next year.
And who would be a typical adoptee that would take on?
You know, for a Mustang, we do need an experienced
yeah.
adopter. So we are looking for people who have horse experience. Mustangs make great, reliable trail horses. Actually, if we go on a little further, we do have some Mustangs that were actually part of the Border Patrol.
Oh, cool.
And so from what I understand, the Border Patrol is using more and more Mustangs because of their sure-footedness. You know, we do everything we can to support the plight of the Mustangs. A lot of people are interested in adopting them, but you do need a specialized trainer. They've never been around people, so they have to learn that we're friendly and we're going to give them carrots and love. And actually, it looks like Red and Max are turned out. These are our Border Patrol Mustangs, but I will drive you by them.
And why does the Border Patrol turn them over to you?
They're for their retirement. Mm-hmm. So we have a good partnership with them. We have taken, I believe, four horses from them. Red and Max, who are still here, they are permanent residents just because of their age. We've had four senior horses over 20 adopted in the past quarter, so we're really proud of that.
The adoptees, what are they, just have them live on their land and take care of them?
Yeah, you know, some people call them pasture pets. Maybe they have two horses and one of their horses has passed away from old age and they are looking for a companion for that horse. So that's the most frequent reason a senior gets adopted.
Last time I was here, you were showing me a couple that they were buddies.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes a difference in their lives. They're much more social animals than one would imagine.
They definitely are social. You know, they live in herds in the wild and that that instinct is still here and it doesn't go away. Some of them have different attachments than others, but some do become very bonded. So if a horse is adopted out, you will hear them whinnying and calling for each other when their friend leaves. You know, they will get used to it and make new friends. I'll just point out these three coming up. These are also from the same San Luis Obispo County rescue. And we really have to thank Animal Services in Slo County. They have a really difficult job of actually going in and being the ones who are seizing animals and taking them out of those terrible situations. So these three, Firecracker, Kai, and Sally, are our three newest rescues. They just came in about a month ago. And I will just open up this gate quickly. This is what we call Draft Hill. So we have some of our draft horses here. And there are... And our cart's a little bit like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. So you gotta hang on.
A little bonus adventure.
So this is our Draft Hill area. They're kind of free to roam up here. And it looks like they're hiding from us a little bit behind one of their favorite oak trees.
Well, I think they're liking the shade right
yes,
now, too.
Yes, they are. So the light-colored horse on the right, that is Lover Boy, and he is very shy. And then we have Melissa is the black horse on the right. And then Scarlet is the one in the middle. Scarlet's the most friendly, probably checking us out, wondering if we have treats. Mm-hmm. So these horses were all rescues from an auction in Canada. Your listeners may remember there was a drug named Premarin that is still used, but it's not as common anymore. A drug for estrogen replacement, and it's actually shorthand for pregnant mare urine. So the way that this drug was originally made was they would keep horses like Scarlet. You won't be able to see it from where we're sitting, but she has a number tattooed on her side. They were actually kept in stalls, weren't able to move around very much, and that urine was collected. The offspring from keeping them pregnant at all times to gather that urine were often discarded and sent to auction. So you know, two of our horses are offspring from Premarin horses, and one was actually used in production.
Do they still do that?
They do, but from what I understand, it's not happening in the U.S. as much anymore, but other countries, I believe, are still using those drugs. But these ones were rescued at the time that many of those farms shut down, a lot of horse rescues.
So of your residents here, some are rescues that are not adoptable.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
They will live out their life here.
That's right. I'd say probably 70 to 80% of our herd are what we would call sanctuary residents. You know, we do adoptions and we offer sanctuary, and essentially we evaluate horses as they come in and kind of decide if we think they're here for life or if they might be adoptable. And that's based on health issues they may have or their age and if we think it's just time for them to have a calm life.
If somebody was interested in adopting one of your horses, what's the basic process and what would be the cost?
You would have to come here to the sanctuary, meet with our equine care manager, and then you would meet the horse that you're interested in. Actually, we have a form online. It doesn't obligate you to adopt from us, but it just gives us a little more information about what you're looking for in a horse so we can see if we can match it to a horse we have or keep an eye out for a horse we might have coming in. Once you fill out the form, Sarah will give you a call and set up an appointment. At the appointment, we'll meet that horse, see if you mesh. If you do, you can put a foster hold on that horse, and then you have kind of first choice of that horse. If it's a riding prospect, you would set up an appointment. Sometimes the horses have not had quite enough riding hours on them before we release them. We want to make sure that every horse is safe and ready for their next career.
On an annual basis, can you guesstimate how many horses are fostered?
I believe we have, you know, between 10 and maybe 15 or 17 a year that go out. It just depends on the year.
I know people have had horses where they're companions, mm-hmm. and the one horse takes care of the other. One horse might be blind. Have you had that where one is compassionately caring for the other horse?
Actually, we have two horses here. One's name is Aloni, and he is fully blind, and he really relies on his companion, who is right next door to him. He follows her around. They're turned out together. They do really make a wonderful pair.
And the little worker vehicles that go by, those are paid employees?
Yes, we have 10 employees total. We have 5 ranch hands who really work hard to keep this place spotless.
This is a nonprofit, and this is a huge overhead. How do you fund it?
We rely solely on donations. We're passing our round pen. This is where our thoroughbreds and any horse that's in the foster program, where they do most of their training with our equine care manager. This is our thoroughbred alley. This is Johnny B. Bueno. He's a beautiful gray horse. He's available through our foster to adopt program. We're coming up to our burros. This is Jenny. The rose colored one is Lucky. And coming up on the rear is Brownie. Hi. Hi, Jenny. Burros, they're the same animal as donkeys. So we call them burros just because that's the term used when they're wild or have come from wild situations. So these burros have all come from Bureau of Land Management. This is Brownie. She is the oldest animal at the sanctuary.
Wow, how old?
She is 41 years old.
Wow.
And what's amazing about Brownie is she's not on any medication. She's just one tough lady. Thank you for coming out to our sanctuary. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Yeah. So if somebody wanted to learn more.
We're open for tours Tuesdays through Saturdays. And then we also have Instagram. We're on Facebook, Red Wings Horses. My name is Desiree, and I am the office manager at Red Wings Horse Sanctuary.
Desiree, thanks again. Yeah. Wonderful day.
Thanks so much for coming.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Red Wings Horse Sanctuary. We'll see you here.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. We're going to take a short break. This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. We hear the term branding thrown around all the time. Sometimes it's simple as a logo, and other times it's a whole lifestyle. One Central Coast company has made it their mission to help people better understand their brand. And host Brian Reynolds was recently curious about what all goes into the process. So he sat down with Louis Camassa, CEO of Empath, a local company that does brand management for businesses and nonprofits.
Simple as could be is brand is every touch point of the customer experience. If you break that down, it's the pre-purchase, the purchase, and the post-purchase experience. That's the customer journey broken down as simply as possible. Everything you do when you go in to buy a product or you go in to get a service, it's that point before you go in, during the service, and then after you leave, what's that experience mean to you?
I'm really glad I asked that because when I think of branding or a brand, almost always what comes to mind is something visual, like a logo, a jingle, packaging maybe. I was disturbed. There's a certain kind of salad dressing I really enjoy that comes in a triangular bottle. And all of a sudden, somebody decided that, still triangular, but it's a different shape. So I'm going to have to write the company one of these days. Tell me a little bit about yourself and sort of how you got to this point today to run this company.
It all started back when I was in high school. In between classes, I was designing websites. This is 20 years ago, before people had email addresses. And I saw the internet. I was like, wow, this is a cool platform to get out there and be able to connect with others and perhaps sell products. I got a project from a local pet store. I developed his website, and we launched it. I remember the first day I launched it, nothing happened. Nobody bought any products. There was no emails coming in. It's like, uh-oh, what did I do wrong? But then a couple days later, I got a sale. A few days after that, a few sales. And then before you know it, in a few months, we were getting sales all over the country. And that's where it clicked for me. I was like, wow, this internet could really help people generate more sales and help brands build out their brand recognition. And it started from there, and then started building up more sites and getting more into the technology side of it, like email and text messaging and building out platforms that help companies connect with their customers. And that naturally evolved into next level, which is really brand and understanding more than just developing a digital platform, but how do you connect with the customer in a way that evokes emotions and that really helps them build that brand awareness that you want to shape and help propel?
I'm thinking it's probably a two-stage process. You want to attract customers and you want to keep customers once you've attracted them.
Exactly. When you think about brand, a lot of people go to visual identity. They go to the logo. They go to the color palette. And those are components of brand. But that's not all brand is. Brand is how people perceive your company and how they think about it when you're not in the room. And if you think about that, it's about your mind. It's about what you remember that brand. And it usually comes down to expectations. So you brought up the bottle of salad dressing. Now, when you go into the grocery store, most people, about 45%, are on autopilot, meaning they're just going in, they're pulling off the brands they know, they look at the logo, they pull it off, they put it in their cart. They actually did a test. They put a man in a gorilla suit, about the size I am, 5'10". They put him in a gorilla suit, and they had him walk around and shop in the grocery store. Then as people were leaving, they asked, did you see the man in the gorilla suit? Most of the people said no. A very small percentage actually saw him. Everybody was checked out. They're just going and mindlessly shopping. When you think about brand, we've already have that set expectation, which means we don't need to go and think about it. And we only have about 80 to 100 major decisions we can make a day. Whatever we can do to simplify decision-making by looking at that logo and knowing that that's a reputable brand, we're going to do. And it's like Obama had once, they interviewed him. They said, hey, how is it they're able to make so many important decisions? He goes, well, I simplify the easy ones. They asked him to give an example. He said, well, you know why I wear the same color suit every day? So I don't have to decide what color suit to wear. I just pull it out of the closet.
One less thing
to have to think about. And that gives him the power to think about the more important things.
Interesting. How did you start your company, and when was that started?
So Empath was founded about a year and a half ago. We had sold one of our technology companies, and that went to private equity. And then I didn't make enough to just sit back on the beach and drink Mai Tais all day. I was like, all right, what's the next phase of my business? And I partnered with an ex-Bay Area CEO of a marketing agency up there. He had a 100-person shop, had sold out about 10, 15 years ago, and was bopping between here and there the last few years. And we teamed up, and he has a real big background in traditional media, which is TV, radio, print, and creative. And my background technical, we came together and forged Empath. And we've been helping companies on the Central Coast, which I'm managing the Central Coast. Then he's up in the Bay Area managing that office up there.
I'm not going to ask you client names, but I'm going to ask you about the kinds of companies or the kinds of products that you your company works with. Like, is it dog food? Is it kitchen furniture? I mean, probably a vast array.
When you think about brand, there's so many different ways you can go with brand. Like you said, you can do creative, you can do brand strategy, communication. Same thing with working with different clients in different industries. Is we're able to come in and parachute into any industry and uncover the truth. That's part of our process.
Sounds dangerous.
It sounds dangerous, and sometimes it is, depending on who you're talking to. And everybody always starts with their arms crossed. Nobody wants to say anything bad. And eventually you build trust, you build rapport, and then they open up and they tell you things that you need to know to help the company.
Right.
We've worked with nearly half the Fortune 15 over the years, companies like Microsoft, Apple, Disney, and those were years ago. And on the Central Coast, we've worked with a lot of local ones too. Our goal now is to help companies realize what brand is, the brand consciousness, is thinking about the customer journey. Because price is so much more of a commodity now than it once was, because there's so much competition. So now people are refocusing on experience. Going in and actually having a good experience while you're buying the product after is having good customer loyalty. That's where we help companies really shine, is thinking through that whole pre-purchase, purchase, and post-purchase experience.
So interesting to me, because effect of the internet, you know, it really changed everything, and probably in many cases ways that we don't even know yet. We just know it's changing, and we'll find out as we can look backwards ahead. But if you imagine our ancestors walking down the street in a town where they lived, they would see a sign. it was a boot. It was probably a place to go get your shoes repaired or boots made or the butcher shop, so forth. Then advertising took on a whole more, ubiquitous thing. And I remember that in the early 20th century, the idea of buying a product was about value. And then starting around World War II, it was about how it replaced or complemented your personality. Like if you weren't sexy unless you smoked this cigarette or whatever. Now with the internet, it's a whole different world. And in one instance particular, I've heard that if you're a savvy internet shopper, you look for the cheapest whatever. And it tends to drive prices down and profits, I'm sure, along with them. And so to me, just as a layman, the idea of thinking about the brand in a global sense and customer loyalty, that's pretty huge.
It is. And what happens is a lot of companies don't realize that digital is just a tool. It's not a replacement. It's not just a bespoke plug-and-play element you add. You don't just create a Facebook page. You create a website. You just don't integrate them. You have to think through all of those touch points cohesively. And you have to create that seamlessness in your business. And if you're not empowering your team to use digital in a way that empowers the others and your customers, then you really haven't gotten it right. And a great example is one of my friends went to Lowe's the other day. He went online to buy his roofing materials and all the different materials he needed to build out his roof. And he did it online. When he went into the store to go and pick it up, they couldn't find the order. And the person that could find the order was at lunch. So they had to wait 15 minutes for that. And the person came back and he found the order, but then he couldn't drive the forklift to get it off the pallets that were too high. So they had to get that guy. And it took him about an hour and a half to get what he ordered online from the store into his car. It's like, wow, yeah, they built the online component to take the order, but they didn't train their team on how to fulfill that.
Right.
And it took more time for him having to go online and do it than if he just went into the store and did it there. That's digital transformation. It's empowering your whole team. It has to come before you even touch any of the digital, before you write a single line of code, before you design out any graphics. It's about empowering your team to understand how digital works.
Right.
And the reason behind why people use it is they want convenience. It's all about creating a seamless transaction. People go online to shop because they don't want to deal with all the customer care. They want to deal with the lines. They want to get in. They want to get out. So when you're an employee of that company, you know that, hey, they ordered online so they can get in here, pick it up, and leave.
Right.
And that's what a lot of companies miss out on. They just think they're adding in these components because that's the new thing and they have to.
My father-in-law was a steel salesman. And of course, American steel companies are almost something of the past. But his perennial problem, his territory was the Midwest. It's around Chicagoland. But promising something at a certain price, at a certain schedule, then the factory couldn't deliver back in Pennsylvania. And so it seems to me that, just as you say, from the first impulse a customer has to research something that he or she needs to picking it up either by way of home delivery or at a physical store, it's a seamless thing that there's probably a bunch of vulnerable points along the chain.
That's right.
And so it's a package.
It's a package. It's the customer journey. And that's what we help analyze. Going back to steel maybe 20 years ago, I was all digital. I was like, hey, we don't have to talk to the customer. Everything's over the phone and through email. And my father was a salesman for Mitsubishi EDM, and he worked in a machine shop. And I used to grow up there in the summers, helping cut machine and do all the simple work and carrying and cleaning.
Wow.
I know that business. And he was always bringing customers out, always going to dinner, you know, golfing, meeting for coffee. He's like, man, why don't you just go online and just do it all through email? He goes, no, nothing replaces the in-person communication and relationship building.
Right.
I didn't believe it for 20 years until maybe 5 years ago. I saw the power of it is going out and connecting with people, not just calling them, not just going on FaceTime or Zoom, but actually meeting them face-to-face, shaking their hand, and having a coffee or a meal with them. And I think that's where things are going back to now is people see, we want efficiency, we want convenience, we want to go online, but we also want that connection with others because as humans, we crave that.
I'd like to talk more about the internet. One of the things I used to say about computers is they make things happen quicker and they never sleep. I mean, we have to sleep, but they don't. And so I think sometimes, you know, through muscle memory and other things, we imagine that our lives are dictated by them or that, you know, the person behind the counter is not as smart as the computer and what message it's giving you. And so it's both a blessing and a curse. How do you maximize the blessings and minimize the curse of the internet and the culture?
There's an absolute balance like anything in life. There's a way to use these tools to better your life. And I used to always think technology was helping to make people happier. But then in the last few years, I've really realized it's not. It's making people more stressed out. It's making them work more hours because you have that phone in front of you 23 hours out of the day within arm's reach. People are calling. They're texting. They're messaging. They're leaving voicemails. They're leaving emails. They're getting social media messages. All this technology has been great to connect us as a world, but has totally damaged our ability to manage our time effectively because we're getting interrupted. All these disruptions are causing more stress and anxiety. So we try to do is when we look at technology, we look at it now as a tool. We don't look at that as the be-all, end-all. It might be a critical point in the customer journey, but beyond that is the experience that they have as a customer. And that experience is going to include digital. But we look at all the components and map out a customer journey that includes digital, includes tactile. Like if you go to maybe 20 years ago, email was so new. When you got an email, you get excited. You jumped up and down. And if you remember AOL, it used to say, you've got mail.
Right.
And you'd get that little message. And you'd be like, yeah, this is so cool. And then what has happened in the last maybe few years is now you get an email like, oh, another spam mail. And you're deleting it.
Right.
But you go back to the actual mailbox. Back then, you're getting all this junk mail. Now you get something in the mail. You're all excited. It's like, wow, I haven't got something in the mail in a while.
Uh-huh.
It's tactile. And it's gotten less popular now. So we look at marketing. It's like, what can we do to connect with an audience? Because what we want to do is we want to tell a brand story, and then we want to distribute it in a way that people could relate to. And that might be through email. It might be through social media. But more likely or not, it might be through one-on-one. It might be through direct mail. It might be through TV or radio. It really just comes down to how that message needs to be received. And more importantly is, where is it less competitive to where we're really going to get great awareness?
I mentioned earlier that I was a psych major at Berkeley and remain very interested in cognitive psych issues, how people process information. And what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of our perception and decisions subsequent are based on emotion, who we are, our prejudices, our hopes, our fears, not so much the intellect. But one of the disadvantages of the internet is it's not linear. It's not a story per se. It's more like a hotel of many rooms, and you go into one room and there's another room through there. And so because I believe strongly that people most of the time learn from stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end, that's why the internet has to be a part of the story but not the story. You know, if you can describe a story and engage your customer so that they're a participant and it's good for them, that's powerful.
It's extremely powerful, and you hit the nail on the head. Is they did a study. They looked at people that suffered traumatic brain injury. And what they looked at is they had specific issues with their emotional cognizance. They couldn't emotionally connect. But logically, they knew they had to eat lunch. Hey, I got to eat lunch. I know that. But emotionally, they weren't able to process what to eat because that's where you make decisions.
Hmm.
Decisions are made with emotions and then justified with logic. And that's true in many cases that they've done. The other thing with storytelling is that's the best way to evoke emotions is through story. We've been telling stories since we've been cave people, drawing
right.
artwork on the cave walls. And now it's about taking that story in a way that people can relate to. And in some cases, that story could be polarizing because you're going really niche into an audience and you're going to connect with people that really understand that. I think gone are the days where you're a generic company and your message just relates to all. Now we're niching down to more specialized brands and serving their audience very specifically. And sometimes that message is going to repel and other times it's going to attract. But when they tell that story authentically, that's when you truly connect.
Right. And as we also had talked earlier, it's kind of mysterious and quite difficult to describe in concrete terms how you acquire a customer for the first time. But to keep them as a customer, to have them be a repeat customer is the key. I mentioned my son works for a large pickle company, and they have the advantage, apparently, of customer line. And sometimes they get compliments, and sometimes they get complaints. Like, my pickles don't taste like, you know, they did a month ago. And I guess the true answer is that's because it was a Canadian pickle a month ago, and now we're getting it from Southern California or whatever. Paying the best on the seasons, but I think probably for their company, one of the hallmarks is when people say something nice or not so nice, they get feedback. You know, somebody calls them or somebody interacts with them, and it's huge, I think.
Feedback's critical, and also change is really challenging when you have a brand and people have been using that brand. Like when I go to the grocery store and I buy salad dressing, I'll buy Newman's Own. I've been doing that for 15 years now. I go in, it's the same flavor every time. It's the same taste. I open it. I know it's going to be what
right.
I want. Now, if they had changed that, now I'm thinking, oh, this is different. Well, maybe I'll try something else. But usually it's really challenging to get a brand to come in and usurp another brand when you've already been loyal to it.
Right.
When they make a change, they lose a little bit of that.
Right. Yeah, it's more of a time of vulnerability.
Time of vulnerability.
Right.
When you think about like Netflix, for instance, when they were in the DVD mailing service and they had a pivot into streaming, and then the streaming took off and the DVD sector went down. They're like, right. Oh, let's split this out and let's build its own brand. They came up with that name Quickster, and then that just failed horribly. Well, it's because they tried pivoting and they tried separating out their audience without really knowing what audience was which. And that you have to really know who your audience is when you make changes like that. If it's a nostalgic audience, which is just going back to it because they remember it from 10, 20 years ago, you have to be very careful in making that change.
Interesting. I assume you use focus groups like customers. And I mean, you talk to employees, but you also talk to customers. And
we do. The focus groups are challenging because you get a strong personality, just like when you're on a jury. If you get one strong personality, they could sway people's decision.
Yeah.
What we try to do is go one-on-one, and then we'll do surveys and do other things to understand the dynamics. But when we could talk to some of the key purchasers or some of the key customers and generate some of that story and talk to their team and then see some of the reviews out there, what online has done that's really cool is it's aggregated a lot of feedback. So you can go to companies like Glassdoor, and you can look at how the internal employees think of the company. You can go to Amazon, look at, like, that's how they became popular. I had reviews on products. I could read that. And you can start segmenting out and finding sentiment, tracking, and really analyzing what people think and feel. Because we're not just about logically how it works and the specifics of it. We want the emotion. How does that product or service make you feel?
How do you get companies to let you do your job? By that, I mean, it's such an, I'm going to use the word intimate. When you come into a company, you've got to get down and dirty. You've got to look at the bathrooms and look at the product and talk to employees and talk to maybe disgruntled people, customers and their employees. How do you get the permission to do that?
The first thing we do is we lay that out on the table before we even sign the deals. We're going to go in deep. We're going to uncover things you're going to like, some things you're not going to like. But at the end of the day, you're going to have the truth of your company that's going to make you propel faster into the future. So we start with what's called a brand workshop. So we bring all together, it could be 20, 30 people into a room, and we start going through ideation. We start going through ideas, start getting stories from them and building consensus. And when you start that, some people have their arms crossed, they don't want to be there, they're not having fun. But after a while, you start building trust, you start getting their ideas heard, you start putting them on a board, now they start having buy-in. They start seeing the way they could navigate and change their brand. That's how we start, and then we'll go and we'll do one-on-one interviews. We'll go in and do even competitor research. We do secret shop. We'll go in and see the cobwebs in the corner. If it's a restaurant, we'll see how long it takes to get a table. What's the turnaround time on food? We look at all of that, and oftentimes we'll go in online too and look at the reviews and compare that. So it's really the challenge with all of these brands is understanding that brand is much more than just the visual identity. It's every touch point of that experience. And a lot of companies don't invest in that. The ones that do, if you look at the top biggest brands out there, like the Apples of the world, that's really where they focus, is on customer experience. If you look at Microsoft, for instance, very different, right? More utilitarian, function-based. They didn't really get behind the emotion or the user experience. They are now. If you look at the new Microsoft Surface and how it's designed and how new Windows 10 is updated and designed out, now it's more experience-based. It's more pleasing to the eye than it is functional.
That's so interesting. And, you know, again, with issues of time, if you make a bad decision or an uninformed decision, you may or may not be able to catch up, you know, given the pace of things.
It is. It's challenging, especially in design world. Most of the design changes you're going to make, if not all of them, you're going to have people that don't like it. Say, I don't like this change, like the Cal Poly logo that they redid recently. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a greater majority of people disliked it. They had 7,500 students that were against it that signed the survey. The challenge is, though, is how do you build consensus in going out with that new design and making sure that the majority do like it? And that's where that research comes in. And a lot of companies, they just start with the creative first. They just start with the fun stuff. And they don't do that research, which you have to get into the trenches.
Right.
Sometimes we'll go in the back of the kitchen, we'll be a short order cook for a day and see what it's like back there, see how the team's dynamic is. Or we'll go in, if we're working in hospitality, we'll stay for a few nights at the hotel and we'll touch the thread count on the sheets and see what that feels like and really kind of understand it from the customer perspective.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Lou Camassa, CEO of a local company, Empath, that does brand management for customers large and small, both locally and globally. Thank you so much, Lou.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.